Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
With you with the positive mind, helping you build your self-esteem. Well, now there's a question for you.
Yeah, maybe or maybe not.
Maybe or maybe not. That's what we want to talk about today. Yes, we want to discuss this whole issue of self-esteem. For years, we have had this idea that self-esteem is a good thing. The higher your self-esteem, the better off you are. It's difficult not to feel that self-esteem is important. We all want to like ourselves, prove ourselves, have reasons to believe that our virtues and our talents are recognized. We want others to see us as likable, competent, and trustworthy. But then on the other hand, someone says, yeah, but pride is a deadly sin, and you have to be careful with narcissism. Narcissism, which is interpreted as an exaggerated self-esteem, and that's widely desired as or it's regarded as a highly undesirable trait.
And also, Armand, self-esteem has been one of the factors that has been used in health level assessments or health, the ability to keep one's health, meaning that usually, historically, people with lower self-esteem who score lower in self-esteem, mental tests and aptitudes, etc., historically have been attributed lower levels of health, mental and physical, less incidence of longevity, etc., than people with higher self-esteem.
In New Zealand, for example, Roberta, the researchers found after correcting for social class, IQ, depression, and height and weight ratio, young adolescents with low self-esteem had an increased risk for poor mental and physical health, poverty, and criminal activity by their mid-20s.
Mm-hmm.
In a group of 9 to 11-year-old Florida boys with low self-esteem had a 60% higher rate of drug dependency 10 years later. So it's convincing evidence that people with high self-esteem are happier as well as more likely to undertake difficult tasks and persist in the face of failure. So self-esteem has to be a good thing,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yeah, they live longer according to the statistics. They socialize better. They're better able to maintain long-term relationships and so on and so forth. And every time you see any kind of description of any kind of disorder, it's likely that you'll find that low self-esteem is one of the factors for the lack of, good health or the lack of, as I was saying. So, yes, it has been overrated, perhaps.
Well, here's the reason it's been overrated. Other studies have failed to confirm the virtues of high self-esteem. And now the Harvard Mental Health Letter comes out with a report, a very big report. Child abusers and criminals in general do not suffer from low self-esteem. In experimental situations, by the way, high self-esteem does not lower the risk of aggression. Children's belief in their own academic ability is only modestly correlated with success. But among therapists, among people who are abusers, they find a high level of self-esteem, meaning that these people think that they're special.
They think highly of themselves.
Highly of themselves, and therefore have the right to punish and abuse, mm-hmm, and feel justified in doing so. Especially among perfectionists and people who like to, you know, who justify and they like everything to be just.
And this is according to scores obtained through testing. The famous one is the Rosenberg self-esteem scale.
Ah, the old Rosenberg self-esteem.
Which I think is one that would be given to anyone patients or students or, you know, in any situation where self-esteem would, there would be a need to assess it, this would be one of the tests. And it's pretty simple and straightforward, and you score between 1 and 30, 30 being the highest, 20 being the average. And so this, according to what the Harvard Medical Health Mental Health Letter says, someone who is, let's say, a pedophile could score very high in this test. Is that right, Armand?
Yeah,
right.
They could score very high on a Rosenberg self-esteem scale, and so do narcissists, and so do manic people.
Right.
So you could have narcissism itself, which is having an unusual perception of yourself, exaggerated perception of yourself. Mania, which is going even further than that, having the belief that you're almost all-powerful, you know? You're all out there, and like you're the king of the world, and you have a right to disrespect others. Those are considered high levels of self-esteem unless you redefine self-esteem.
Right.
Now, of course, that's what everybody would do if you challenged it, because here's what the deal was. The deal was psychotherapy. They sold psychotherapy on the idea that psychotherapy helps a patient who is depressed. And the way it helps a person who's depressed is that patient who is depressed has low self-esteem, is the assumption.
Mm-hmm.
And so, therefore, their low self-esteem makes them depressed because they look at themselves, they criticize themselves, they sit at home, they don't go out. And what the therapist does is very often what they call supportive therapy. And if you think about the jack of a car, when you're lifting up a car, you know, when you get a flat tire, that's what the therapist does. He jacks you up.
That's a great analogy.
You know, he's jacking
metaphor,
you up. And,
yes.
And, you know, jack me is what, please, therapist.
Jack me up.
Jack me up. And in effect, what the therapist does is he tells you what's good about you. And he tells you, oh, you know, you look at you. Your head's down in the dump. You should pick your head up. And it's called supportive therapy. They remind you in a very simple way. But, you know, this is no different than your parents did your whole life when you were depressed. They always tell you, look on the bright side.
Right.
Children in Europe are starving. You know, and they do any number
not
of
in
things.
Europe.
And not in Asia either anymore.
Where are
in
they
Darfur.
Starving? Yeah, right.
All right. There are plenty of places, you know.
Yeah.
In Brooklyn, you know.
Sure.
How did we get so serious all of a sudden?
I don't know, but
that
let's...
That was very quick. When you thought about starving people around the world,
I had an image and it made me sad, yes.
Me too. Therapists rarely see people with high self-esteem. Okay, now, of course, so therapists believe...
But just a moment, Armand, sorry for interrupting, but then also we need to say that therapists rarely will see someone who is very narcissistic and who is very full of themselves in an inflated sort of way.
Right.
Those
people
they
won't
don't go
to therapy.
Right, don't go for help.
So the way therapists judge the effectiveness of their treatment is on this small group of people who have the low self-esteem, because they do not treat people with high self-esteem, because people with high self-esteem rarely go to therapy.
Right.
So, therefore, we are seeing everybody with low self-esteem. Now, this makes a good point. I know many therapists who are depressed. So, if depression is a sign of low self-esteem, and a therapist, therefore, has low self-esteem because they're depressed, and if you ever meet the average therapist, they're very sour, you know, dour, sour. they're a drag. I mean, a lot of them are deadly. It took me ages to find a lively crowd. But if you have a depressed therapist, and then a depressed therapist is trying to treat somebody who's depressed, they can't do it. Because it's not only the self-esteem, it's like you just can't get happier with somebody who's not happy.
Very well said. And, Armand, it sounds to me like the first thing that needs to be addressed is the fact that a therapist may be coming from an unrealistic assumption that simply because someone walks through my door, that means they have low self-esteem. Well, maybe not. And, I mean, there is a whole new way of looking at self-esteem that I think makes a lot more sense.
We'll get to that
right
later. But in this one, you know, Roberto, let's talk about this very point. If we talk, and this is not to trash all therapists, but just a whole bunch of them. There are a lot of therapists out there who feel, you know, are depressed. And they see somebody who comes in who is more depressed.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes them feel good that they're helping somebody who is worse than they are. You see, so in other words, it really, there's a depression rating scale that should be appropriate here, because if a person who has low self-esteem therapist sees a patient who has even lower self-esteem, and then you help that person raise their self-esteem, it makes you raise your own self-esteem, illusory self-esteem, because you're creating, you're doing this illusion.
Right.
All right, so here's the whole point. The whole point of it is this idea of supporting a person has come into question. Let's talk about child rearing and what we've learned from a lot of the recent studies about child rearing.
Sure.
We used to think, just tell a kid they're great.
Well, not only we used to think, but we were told by the experts, so-called, that it was one of the worst mistakes you could make to criticize your child, and that the best thing to do would be to encourage them by validating and approving and complimenting whatever they may choose to do. And so that's the kind of thing that, if you transport it into a therapist's office, is very similar to what the therapist does with an adult who comes in and feels, you know, low about themselves, and the therapist says, oh, but you are a wonderful person. You are fantastic. You are a good human being, and you should not feel that way about yourself. It doesn't work because, A, it's not an honest, a compliment is not an honest assessment of the other individual's
qualities.
Well,
you're telling me that you never compliment people.
I do not compliment people, Armand.
Neither do I.
I stay clear of complimenting.
I don't think I do. You know, Roberta, did you ever notice the phenomena when a patient, and I know you've seen this with the people you see, a person comes in and I'm evaluating them, right? Coming in for an evaluation, and I see that somebody who had a really rough life got through it somehow and survived. And I say to them, you know, I said, after looking at what you've been through, I am shocked, surprised at how adaptable your mind was and how intelligently you found alternatives. And you're a very intelligent person. And when they look at me, when they hear me say that, they think I'm, quote, complimenting them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they look at me and they say, ah, you say that to everybody. As if to say, you're saying something to me to try to make me feel better. But the truth of it is, it's really what I believe. I saw brilliance in the way that they stepped away from their own background, their craziness. You know, they really survived in a brilliant kind of way. Mm-hmm. And I see that. So when I say it, I don't say it to make you feel good. I say it to say to you, oh, what an observation. We both can work with the assumption that you have a very flexible mind.
Mm-hmm. But see, I think that people are sensitive and smart and can sense when you're telling the truth and when you are throwing out compliments, Armand. So I think that even though someone may like to hear from someone they look up to, like yourself, they may like to hear you say that they are, that you're amazed at what they have accomplished, unless you believe it yourself on some level, unless you feel it, unless you embody that statement just showers over them but doesn't stick. So I think that the reason why a lot of people are able to eventually allow your validation into their hearts and minds is because when you say it, it comes from a place of truly experiencing it yourself. You experience the beauty in them for real, and then somehow you communicate it from a place of honesty, not from a place of supportive therapeutic approach.
It's the right thing to say. You know, I remember a man who came to see me one time. His name was David. He was a very, very, very unattractive man. When I say unattractive, I mean he had all the wrong things. He had a face that was asymmetrical. He had a nose that was very, you know, and it was just pimples on his face. He was very unattractive. His mother told him he was beautiful. And his mother told him all the time he was gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous. So he was depressed, and he came to me, and I remember he said to me in the first session, he said, you know that I'm at least as good-looking as most men out there and probably better-looking. Why can't I meet any women? And why aren't women attracted to me? And there I was, caught in the conundrum. There I was. He says, you know I'm attractive. And I'm stuck with this information that he's telling me. He says, I know I'm physically beautiful. Now, of course, you know, on some level he is beautiful, and he was beautiful to me. But to the outside world, this man was not physically beautiful. To the outside world, this man, in order to find a mate, was going to have to develop some compensatory stuff to help him get past, because what he had instead was a self-esteem that was inflated based on a total falsehood. And this guy, David, you know, I remember I had to say to him, I said, David, stop. I says, this is not true. And this is early in my career. And I remember the question. I remember bringing it up for review with my supervisor. I remember having a whole group supervision about it, about why did I have to say that to him? Because to me, he was working on this unreality.
Which was probably more damaging in the end than starting from a different point.
So there are different kinds of self, you know, there are different kinds of self-esteem. We should talk about one. Boastfulness, egoism, conceit, self-satisfaction, vanity, those are considered narcissism.
Well, some of those are the capital sins of Catholicism.
Sure, they are. The seven deadly sins are narcissism. Boastfulness. You know, if somebody's boastful of, you know, what I achieved, if somebody's egotism, if somebody is conceited, self-satisfied, vain, that's considered narcissism. And when we're talking about narcissism, we're not necessarily talking about self-esteem. Violent criminals in prison turn out to have an extraordinarily high level of narcissism, but they only have an average level of self-esteem. See, you could have a high level of narcissism, you could be boasting, you could be proud, you could be vain, but in the bottom line, you don't believe in yourself. You could have a medium or an average self-esteem.
I think that very often, Armand, what one will find is that a person will have, let's say, considerably higher than average self-esteem in one area of their life, and maybe considerably lower levels of self-esteem in a different area of their lives. So it's very possible that most of us have different levels of self-esteem in different aspects of our daily life.
That's a good point, Roberta, because let's think about that for a minute. What are the different areas? Let's think about the physical area. Attractive.
Mm-hmm.
Are you attractive? That's it. And how's your self-esteem around your attractiveness? Well, I know a lot of people who have a lot of self-esteem around their attractiveness, as long as they've got their makeup and their clothing and their shoes and their, you know, and they got the right stuff on.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I used to live next door to a world-famous model in an apartment house, and she was thought of as one of the greatest models of all times, beautiful, spectacular, the world bowed at her feet. And she was a neighbor, and we both took our trash out to the same trash receptacle. And so when she took her trash out, incinerator, I think it was, and I took my trash out, I'd see her in the hallway, and did she look terrible? Oh, my God, she had without her makeup on, without her clothing on, without that stuff on, she was just an emaciated, she'd look like a ghost. Mm-hmm. And she was totally unattractive. But her beauty, the world sees her. She was one of the most beautiful women in the world, according to the world. So you could have a narcissism based on your appearance that might be based on your appearance when you're accoutremented,
mm-hmm.
or an attractiveness that's based on your natural beauty. I mean, do you think, not you, but Roberta, but those of you who are listening, on a scale of 1 to 10, how attractive do you think you are? Is it shakeable? Are you a 7? But if somebody comes along and says to you, you know, you're looking older by the day, do you suddenly drop down to a 3?
Well, that's what I was going to say next, that one of the ways in which I assess levels of self-esteem and their solidity is by how fragile they are. Because, like you just said, one could have a sense of self-esteem that sounds rather high, but then if at the first disapproving individual that comes your path, that sense of self-esteem drops, well, then it might not have been really coming forth from inside you. It may have been something that has been given to you from the outside and you've learned to rely on, such as, you know, the model example. Well, she was looked at by everyone else as the most beautiful this and that. So she had developed a self-image that reflected that belief. But did it come, in fact, from the inside, and therefore was it rooted in her being? No. So the moment something threatens that image, it collapses.
So however, are we all, do you think we're all frail physically?
No.
No? I mean, if somebody comes along and says, you know, you're not very attractive. What does it do to you? What does it do to me? What does it do to the average person if they're not validated?
Well,
you know,
that's what I think. I think that some people could collapse, maybe, like, and I think the bigger the discrepancy is between the image and the real inner sense, the more likely it is that a person will collapse at the first sign of invalidation.
You know, Roberta, do you ever see these, when people go to these discos, these very in-dance places, the big ones that are hard to get into, where you have a big line, and you have two guards at the front door, and they're only allowing in the most attractive people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what does it feel like to get online and get dressed? And then to have a bouncer say, "Now you get to the end of the line. If we get down to your type, we'll let you in." But you know, and the people go and they stand online waiting to be chosen as one of the attractive ones.
Wow!
So I guess you know what I say about those people? They have a higher self-esteem because it's not going to be shattered. Mm-hmm. By the doorman, by the bouncer at the door. There was a wonderful...
Or if they like humiliation, maybe they might enjoy being rejected.
Well, and now we have a whole
you
other
know me,
subject.
I always like to present the opposite side.
Sure.
But the other thing I was going to say, I just want to finish that thought before it escapes me, was that then there are some areas where no matter how many people criticize us or invalidate us or tell us that we've made a mistake and whatnot, we are unshakable, and we know on some level that this feeling, conviction, idea cannot be taken away from us.
So let everybody who's listening imagine one area of self-esteem that you have that nobody could take it away from you, no matter what they say.
Right.
Okay, so what could it be?
I think we all, more or less, we all have at least one.
Let's try to find, let's think of areas. It could either be in your physical self.
Right.
It could be in your strength or not, you know, it could be in your strength. You know, you're strong, not strong.
It could be
your
strength.
Willpower.
Could be your intelligence.
Well, okay, are you intelligent? That's a cute thing.
Could be your ability to articulate, to speak, to express yourself. Could be your compassion, you know. Could be your kindness. Could be your ability to network. I know this person who, she has an ability to connect people unlike anyone else. So it could be in your ability to make friends.
How about some basic abilities we have? Your physical self could be in your ability to do certain tasks.
Mm-hmm.
Could be cooking. Are you a good cook? You know, can you shake that? Now, Roberta, let's say somebody comes over to you and says to you, Roberta, I know you're a chef, right? And somebody says to you, you know, you don't know how to boil water. You don't know how to really boil water. You know, and you'd look at them and you'd say, what do you mean?
I would be interested in what they mean by that, yes.
And then they'd say, well, when you boil water, it has to boil with the big bubbles. Can you get it to happen with the big bubbles, not the little bubbles?
Well, you see, Armand, I think that even if the day would come when someone would say to me, you don't know how to cook, because my belief in my ability to cook is pretty much unshakable, no matter what this person might say to me, my conviction and my self-esteem in that department would not crumble. But it could be that one day I might cook something that doesn't taste good, and so I would just say, well, okay, so today that didn't work. So I think, you know, it's not that we have to be perfect in order to reach that level of self-esteem in one area or another, but I think that there is that one way to tell whether our self-esteem is strongly rooted is when it's unshakable. My belief is that in a narcissistic self-esteem,
it's always shakable.
It's always very fragile.
Good. You know, William James, who's a psychologist and philosopher, said that self-esteem is the ratio of genuine accomplishment to the pretension or exaggerated self-promotion.
Hmm.
So you're comparing it to the genuine accomplishment to self-promotion, you know, of how you talk about your accomplishment. In this sense, it involves mainly self-confidence or a feeling of confidence. But William James also mentioned a tone of self-feeling that is independent of objective causes for satisfaction.
You know, Armand, I would have a question about that, but I see it's 1:27, so maybe I'll save my question.
You save your question as we get along. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. We are talking about self-esteem, and we're questioning the value of self-esteem, actually. We're questioning the value of working with self-esteem as if it is a powerful tool to help people recover from a number of things, including what you may be doing with dietary control and trying to help people with that, or even physical trainers who, you know, I know physical trainers who work with people and they work and that person gets, you know, lifts like 2 ounces and the trainer is just complimenting them right and left. Look at what you've done. Look how great this is. Look how fantastic you are. Look at your will. Look at your spirit. And I don't know. Does that help the person really work harder, or does it help them work less?
You
it's
know,
a question.
I come from a culture and an era where it was believed that in order to help children develop to the best of their potential, adults needed to be rather stern and, I would say, stingy with the approval. And that would hopefully push the child to prove him or herself. And so it sounds to me like what you're describing here, Armand, is almost a reaction to a couple of centuries of that approach where children were stifled and criticized too much. And now, because we've realized that that's not good necessarily in that way, now we try to do the opposite with children and adults alike.
And there's a place in the middle there.
Right, right.
There's a place in the middle that we're going to find. This is Armand DeMille, Roberta Maria Atti. We're going to take a short break. When I come back, I'm going to play you an old, old piece of music by Oscar Brown Jr., which I think you'll find fascinating, and about a person's sense of themselves. We'll take a short break.
Always live by this golden rule. Whatever happens, don't blow your cool. You gotta have nerves of steel and never show folks how you honestly feel. I've lived my whole life this way. For example, take yesterday. I breathed home happy, bringing her my pay. Her note read, "So long, Sappy, I have run away. I threw myself down across our empty bed, and this is what I said." So loaded I tore up my car. The judge threw the book at me, and when I read his sentence, there I said,
Oscar Brown Jr. It's been so long. Oscar Brown Jr. You know, Oscar Brown Jr. did some beautiful stuff way back when, some children's stuff as well. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you with A Positive Mind with Roberta Maria Atti. We are talking about the uses and misuses of self-esteem. This whole idea of self-esteem and that all you got to do is build your self-esteem and it'll make you better. Now, you know, spouse abusers who participated in a program. Now, this is about reporting, Roberta, which I think is such an interesting thing. Because, again, the people we're getting the reports from are people who are in therapy, people of high self-esteem, generally, in general, do not go to therapy. People of low self-esteem generally go to therapy and say, "Give me some steam." Right? I want more esteem.
Mm-hmm.
Spouse abusers who participated in a program aiming at raising their self-esteem reported that they were, after the program, this is now, they said, okay, now if you're a spouse abuser, you've got to have low self-esteem. If you're abusing your wife or your husband, verbally or physically, then you must have a low concept of yourself. So here's our concept, they said in group. We're going to form groups, and we're going to have men and women who are abusers be in a group and work at building their self-esteem, which they did. And they had a number of groups, and these spouses built their esteem, and they all reported they had higher self-esteem at the end of the group program, and they all reported that they were less abusive with their mates, but nobody interviewed the mates. The mates, however, said, "Oh no, nothing's changed." So the people who were abusers who had this supposedly low self-esteem now felt better about themselves, but were doing the same thing anyway. Right. It didn't change much. Same with children, people who abuse children. You know, they're just perception of themselves is different.
Right, and I think it really has a lot to do with perception. And I think in the case of narcissistic disorders, in all of the disorders that fall under that umbrella, there is already a distorted perception of the self anyway in all different areas and aspects of the self, and self-esteem is one of them, and it could be inflated, as what you're describing, or actually, I think it also could be deflated. I think that, believe it or not, Armand, I do think that sometimes what sounds like low self-esteem could actually be a sign of someone with a narcissistic disorder, in the sense that the person may be trying to appear like they diminish themselves in order not to look boastful. Do you know what I mean?
Well, there is this kind of, you know, I think about the Japanese, and I think about the traditional Japanese who humble themselves because so as not to be seen as boastful, and that many people may humble themselves accordingly, you know, because, oh, I'm just nothing. I am a nothing. And, you know, the people who are givers in the ones who are compulsive givers, who I'm nothing, it's all up to you. I support you. You're my wonderful person. I give to you. It's only because you're the great one. I'm nothing. In a way, that's a form of grandiosity.
That's the word I was looking for.
I support you and make you great. Therefore, and I'm nothing. I'm a nobody. I don't count.
Mm-hmm. You know, however, it's you who are great. Be careful not to get rid of me, or else you'll be nothing.
Well, you see, the additional strategy of that is, and then when you become the target for being out front, because people will eventually pick on you, they won't pick on me. Mm. They'll pick on you. I know many people who are followers and not leaders for that very reason, because they don't want to become the targets.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't have low self-esteem. They have high self-esteem for producing people. Now, this whole question about this brings to mind one thing that everybody in the audience can do, a behavior that you can all do right now, starting now for the rest of your lives. Whenever you tell somebody positive something about themselves that is positive, work at the very specific thing about that they have done, as opposed to a generalization about their personality or their whole self. Because you don't know the whole self. You can't say to a person, you are such a loving being, when you know, you don't know that they might be hurting their children. You can't say that about people, but you could say, the way I saw you just helping that person now was really with a beautiful, loving skill. I love your skill at helping people. A compliment which is based on a moment's reality.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore that with your children as well.
That sounds true.
To say the positive is about what I am giving you, positive feedback about the very thing you're doing, but not a generalization. And you try not to state generalizations about people. You try not to say, you are so exquisitely beautiful.
Mm.
Tell a person what's beautiful about them. I like your nape. If you're a nape person, you know.
What's a nape?
A nape.
I don't know what a nape is.
I'm not going to tell you.
All right. I'll have
Roberta?
I'll have to ask my friends then.
There are nape men out there. N-A-P-E.
Know, as I listen to you, Armand, my mind is, you know, can you hear the wheels are spinning
sure.
in there?
Sure.
I'm thinking that, you know, I think where we went wrong, we meaning the culture, the system that used self-esteem as such an important assessment tool, I think where we went wrong is exactly in the generalization. And what I mean by that is to assume that high self-esteem equals this, low self-esteem equals that. If you take self-esteem only, if you take into account only self-esteem in order to assess someone's mental or physical health or you know, anything about them that's complete, that cannot be a complete assessment. Self-esteem can only be a helpful tool for assessment when in conjunction with a lot of other assessments.
Makes a lot of sense.
About
sure.
who the person is and what they do and how they behave and how they feel about themselves. Because let's take someone like Mozart, Beethoven, one of the geniuses of history. Well, what would their self-esteem be like if we gave them a test? Probably at some point, very low.
Well, I don't know. Mozart was manic, I think. So I think it would have scored very high if he was taking the test.
Depending on when he was taking the test.
That's true.
And so it would be for a lot of other of these geniuses. So I think it cannot be taken into account as a sole measure or the sole prediction of someone's how they're going to do, you know, in life in general.
Well, let me ask you, Roberta, specifically about what kind of, you know, let's take one form of counseling you do, which I know you do a great deal of, is people come to you and they say, I want to change my diet. I want you to give me nutritional guidance, and I particularly want to lose weight. Now, they come to you and they say, I am ugly and fat, and I want you to lose weight. I want to lose weight. And because their self-esteem is on the ground based on this body weight image that they have.
Right.
Now, you can't say as a therapist, well, you know, I really, you don't say for effect that they're beautiful. What do you do? How do you deal with it? What does your mind turn around to?
Well, again, Armand, I think what I have to do is realize that this voice, their inner voice that they hear that says, I'm ugly or I'm overweight or I cannot like myself the way I am, it's not their real voice. Somehow it's a voice that they have heard or learned or absorbed or interpreted. So that's the first thing I have to keep in mind, that's not a baby. When we're born, Armand, do we have high self-esteem? What do you think? Every baby,
you know,
has,
I'll tell you something,
impeccable
though.
Self-esteem.
No, I'm not so sure. If you're a baby who never gets picked up, never gets
touched.
No,
I'm talking about the moment you're born. Like the moment, you know, not after some experience, but like in the beginning when you're just a newborn.
A blob.
Yeah, just a newborn.
Baby.
There's no question. I think these are introjected beliefs. But anyway,
Wait, you bring up a very important point. This is a point you made earlier. An infant doesn't have the ability to perceive oneself.
Yes,
yet.
Exactly. There's no
so
self.
So if you
right.
can't perceive yourself, implicit in this is that I am looking at myself, and if I have low self-esteem, I find me lacking, and if I have high self-esteem, I find me wonderful.
Right. But there,
so
there,
if
there
a person
a
doesn't
self.
Have that, if a person doesn't have the ability to look at themselves, like animals can't look at themselves.
Exactly. That would be one point that I would really work with, that this self is a construct to begin with. Aside from that, I have developed through my years of working with people in this way, an ability to find beauty in everyone, true beauty that they themselves at that moment may not be able to see. And I think that that's something anyone can do, given that they have the intention of doing that. You look at someone, you find their beauty. Once you yourself are in touch with that and you truly see it and appreciate it, then no matter how or what or, you know, what you have to do to communicate it, the next step is find a way to communicate that to the person. And it feels real because it is real. It is there. In every person, like you said before, Armand, at the beginning of the show, there is beauty. It's just that sometimes people are not able to see their beauty. And they measure themselves by a yardstick that is a cultural one. It's a fashion, imposition, or it's the voice of someone else. And so their judgment is covering up this beauty that is there and is always there. If I, as a counselor or a nutritionist or whatever they see me as, if I'm able to see that beauty in them, and if I'm able to reflect it back to them somehow, that's what I find. That's what works best, because then they find it themselves.
If the assumption is yes, and I think one of the they can say you could shape heightened self-esteem by you could confront low self-esteem by clarifying the implicit underlying thoughts and restating them as a hypothesis to be tested. So if a person says, I'm not worth loving, instead of saying to them, oh, yes, you are, you say to them, let's test that hypothesis.
Right.
Okay? Discouraging the generalizations and the errors that result from selective attention, you bring to light, you discuss, you try to get to the bottom of it, and you say, let's evaluate what you're saying. You know, it dawns on me that most physicians are anti-self-esteem. You know, it just seems like every time you go to a doctor...
Well, look at what they have to go through to get it, to make it to medical
school. Every time you go to a doctor, you know, you
they are really abused, you know, Armand, through medical school.
And they abuse the patients.
Well, I think that it comes from the fact that they themselves, in order to make it through the 7 years, whatever they are, they get a lot of abuse from the older doctors, from the teachers, from the system.
I mean, where they do give you compliments is where it looks like they're doing a good job. So if you go to a doctor and the doctor says, oh, good, you lost 5 pounds. How terrific, how fantastic. It makes me look good. You lost 5 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
If he says to you, oh, your arthritis got worse, he doesn't even want to talk to you. You know, if you have migraines and you go to doctors and you try to call them up to tell them the pain is worse, forget it. They don't want to talk to you because their self-esteem is so tenuous.
Yeah.
They don't want to hear reports of failures.
Right.
Sorry to get off track. Back to self-esteem.
No, it's true, but I think it's the system that really fails them even before they fail us. I think, but anyway, yeah, that's a whole other show.
So, in effect, what we're saying...
Armand, I'm sorry, I wanted to finish because you asked me a question.
I'm sorry.
So, if I look at someone who is so convinced that they're unattractive, that they themselves almost tried to hide themselves... because they're so afraid of showing this ugliness, if I'm able to connect to their beauty, then I find that I'm able to bring them there with me. But if you ask me how I do that, I don't think I could tell you.
Ah, but Roberta, you know...
it could not be verbally...
But you're a freaky person.
True.
Because... Roberta has a hobby that I'm not gonna tell everybody about. Roberta has a hobby of macro photography without, she doesn't even know it's called macro. Macro photography of the insides of flowers. This is her hobby. So Roberta will take any flower anywhere, and she carries a little camera with her, and whenever she sees a flower, she's got to photograph it. And I studied photography for 20 years. I studied using Nikon lenses and everything inside out. And I tell you, Roberta, I have done more macro photography than most humans will ever do. But when I look at your work, I am... amazed.
You
now, I don't, this is,
now.
No, but why? Because I'm making you have higher self-esteem?
No, because just that someone could recognize that about me.
It's true. Whenever you send me one of those pictures, I look at it and I go, how did she see this? Where did this come from? Look at it.
But yes, it's the same skill, yes.
But you see that beauty inside. So now, do you think the flower that you photograph feels better when you leave? You know what I mean? I mean, if you're just a flower, if it was a weed who comes in flower, and weeds do flower.
Yeah, they have beautiful flowers. And
gorgeous flowers,
yes.
Right? But nobody pays attention to a mint leaf first.
No.
So Roberta comes along, and she sees this flower, and she photographs it. When she walks out, you know, do you think the flower beams a little bit because somebody saw its beauty? Somebody looked inside and saw the stamen, the pestle, and...
Oh, it's amazing. Dandelions they look like the sun. If you can take a picture, a macro picture of a dandelion, it's like photographing the sun. It's gorgeous, gorgeous.
So you see that in people. Now, here's the thing. If a client comes in to see me, no matter how distorted they are, and I see people who are obsessive and and they can't stop themselves from worrying, and mm-hmm. they can't help it. And I know this about them. And they come in, and they're always self-deprecating, and they're always putting themselves down, and and they don't trust anybody, and they don't trust me. And I look at them, and then they're looking at me, and they're saying, I don't trust anybody, and I especially don't trust you, Armand. And I look at them, and I smile. I don't smile because I'm ridiculing them. I smile because, yes, this is you. Mm-hmm. Yes, this is you, the untrusting young person
yeah.
who survived by not trusting. Yes, I understand that, and I smile. And they think there's something wacky going on. Why am I smiling if they're saying they distrust me? Is it that I don't take them seriously? No, I take them seriously, but herein is your beauty. Here, right here, at this moment, your weirdness, your strangeness, your adaptation, the thing you did, just like the flowers that you photograph, here's your beauty.
Yeah.
But I don't say it to them. I just see it. I feel it. You see, if you feel it, you don't have to tell the person.
Right.
So I never compliment a patient.
No, never. I never
say anything good about anybody.
It could make things worse, I think, to compliment someone.
I just feel like it's a science. I feel like, hey, we're in this together. Don't you recognize what I see? Would you like to see what I see? If you could see yourself with the eyes that I see you, you would feel better automatically.
Right. Yeah,
but I'm not going to tell you how I see you.
But see, I think, Armand, that's the mirroring that they talk about in psychology books. When a parent looks at a child with those eyes, the child mirrors in the eyes of the parent that love, you know. And in a way, I mean, it's kind of a trite thing to say, but aren't you talking about mirroring beauty?
No, because sometimes when a parent looks at a child's beauty, they are mirroring themselves.
Mm, well.
You see? And they see the beauty in their offspring, and they are seeing, this child is mine. I can't tell you the number of people
I
know.
I agree with you. No,
they come to me, and I've had this, I could say, five last week, or the week before. I was out of town last week, who came to me and said, my child, I was told that my child is the most beautiful child that the doctor ever saw.
Wow.
It is the cutest child that anybody has ever seen. How come every child is the cutest child that everybody's ever seen when they get to be between 7 and 10 months? You know?
Yeah.
It's everybody's. And the parent who says it, the parent who wants to believe this, is, I think, in trouble.
No, definitely. Well, but now you're talking about narcissistic engulfing of your children.
Well,
whereby
why does your child have to be the best? Why does your child have to be the most?
Because of the same reason why the doctor who treats your migraines and you call and tell them that you're in pain, they can't accept that. Same reason, because it reflects badly. If that child is not perfect, it reflects badly on me. But that's not love, Armand. That's need. And when parents love their children in that way, well, I think both the parent and the child may have a rocky road ahead of them, which is not necessarily a bad thing. What I was referring to is something else. And in mirroring, what I mean is, like, you know, I was describing to you, you know how I got my idea of photographing the flowers? Because when I walk by flowers that no one even notices because they're so small and invisible, I've learned that there's incredible beauty there. Just like when you're on the highway and you are traveling 60 miles an hour, how are you supposed to look at the flowers that are in the middle of the highway and yet they are there? I guess it's that's what I'm talking about, being able to spot beauty wherever it is, which is everywhere. And talking about trite commenting, but commentary. But I mean, I think in the end, really, that's my secret.
Listen, my friends, this is Armand Amil, Roberta Moriarty. Thank you very much. You know, inscribed on the Temple of Apollo at Delphi are these magical words, know yourself. They are not approve of yourself. It's know yourself. That's the best deal we got. Get to know yourself. Forget about the approval. It'll come. Armand DeMille, Roberta Maria Atti. Get in touch with Roberta, Roberta's website. Roberta for Roberta, the website?
CreativeHealthSolutions.org.
And you can send me an email, armand@brainlink.com. And by the way, my friends, if you did make the donation to WBAI, please honor that donation. Please send that money into BAI because our fund drive was very successful, thanks to you. And what we've, and if you did make a donation for one of the consultations with me, by you can call us immediately and make the appointment. We have a way of checking it out. Just call my office, 212-757-4488, and take advantage of it now while we have the openings. Back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends.